KSVP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The Doge team just announced millions of illegals now have social security numbers. It's happening and it ends today.
The Department of Government Efficiency team has been pushing dubious claims about non-citizens voting in U.S. elections.
For Friday, April 11th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, the latest on the Maryland man who was wrongly deported to El Salvador.
And later, we remember Tony Award-winning composer and lyricist William Fenn.
He wrote very stream of consciousness, but he was a brilliant guy. Then he shaped his material in an interesting way.
And Jeff Bridges transports us back in time to his late 70s jam sessions with old high school friends.
We got a little space and, you know, got a funky four-track tape recorder, and we went to town.
Coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A Louisiana immigration judge says Columbia University activist Mahmoud Khalil can be deported based on the federal government's contention he poses a national security risk. The judge saying she does not have the legal authority to challenge the Secretary of State's determination. As NPR's Adrian Florido reports, that's despite the fact the government never really backed up claims that remarks by Khalil were anti-Semitic.
Khalil's lawyer, Mark Vanderhoot, said in court today that the accusation that Khalil is anti-Semitic is baseless. He said the government provided no further explanation about how Marco Rubio decided that Khalil's protest activity was anti-Semitic. He said Khalil's protests were not against Jews. In fact, he often spoke about the importance of having Jews in the movement for Palestinian rights. He asked the judge to allow him to question Rubio in court. But Judge Jamie Comins rejected that request.
The determination came after a two-hour hearing in an immigration center in Louisiana. Khalil participated in pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia and was detained by federal agents in March. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has rejected a plea for help from Milwaukee health officials trying to clean up lead contamination in schools. Denial comes after Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. cut 2,400 jobs at the agency this month. Catherine Kokel of member station WWM in Milwaukee has more.
Seven schools in Milwaukee have been temporarily closed by health officials this year due to lead dust levels up to 32 times higher than deemed acceptable by the EPA. The culprit is chipped lead paint. Milwaukee officials called in help from the CDC in March to do outreach to vulnerable families and track lead poisoning cases. Aaron Bernstein, the director of the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health, said he couldn't lend any help due to the, quote, complete loss of our lead program. While the average age of a school in the United States is 49 years, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, public schools in Milwaukee are, on average, 82 years old. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Kokel in Milwaukee.
The world's longest-lasting pig kidney transplant has failed. NPR's Rob Stein has details on the setback.
Doctors in New York say they had to remove the pig kidney from Tawana Looney last week because the Alabama grandmother's body rejected the genetically modified organ. The doctors say the kidney was working well, but was rejected after Looney had to cut back her anti-rejection medication due to an infection. Looney is now back on dialysis. Looney received the pig kidney more than 4 months ago in a landmark operation. Doctors say they still hope that genetically modified pig organs could eventually help solve the long-standing organ shortage. Rob Stein, NPR News.
An up end of the week on Wall Street, the Dow gained 619 points. The NASDAQ rose 337 points today. This is NPR. The head of a U.S. military base in Greenland has been fired after pushing back against comments made by Vice President J.D. Vance during a visit to the facility in March, where Vance once again said the U.S. should take control of the Arctic island. Colonel Susanna Meyer, who commands the U.S. Space Force base, was removed from her command Thursday due to what a Space Force spokesperson called a loss of confidence in her ability to lead. The Trump administration has repeatedly expressed its desire to take over Greenland, which is an autonomous territory of Denmark. Trump at one point offered to buy Greenland, despite the fact both Greenlandic and Danish officials have said the island is not for sale. Crows, like humans, seem to have a kind of intuition about basic geometry. As NPR's Noel Greenfield-Boyce explains, it's the first time scientists have found this in an animal.
Regular geometric shapes appear over and over in art and architecture all through human history. Studies show that regardless of age, culture, or education, people are really good at noticing geometric regularity. And it turns out crows are too. In the journal Science Advances, a research group in Germany reports they trained crows to play a computer game in the lab. The birds pecked at a touchscreen with their beaks to get rewards. These crows were able to correctly distinguish regular geometric shapes, like squares and rectangles. Researchers say they clearly had a sense of right angles, parallel lines, and symmetry. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Oil rose $1.43 a barrel to settle at $61.50 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Over the past few weeks, Elon Musk and other members of his Department of Government Efficiency team have started pushing dubious claims about non-citizens voting in U.S. elections, and they are making those claims using what appears to be data from the Social Security Administration, data that a court has blocked some members of the DOGE team from accessing over privacy concerns. Joining us now are NPR Stephen Fowler and Jude Joffe Block. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hey there.
Jude, I want to start with you. DOGE has been looking into Social Security data, and they have made some claims about non-citizens having Social Security numbers. Help us unpack all of this.
Yeah, so just to be clear, non-citizens who are in the country with legal status of some kind do get Social Security numbers. This means they're paying into Social Security when they work. So DOGE began talking about this at the end of March. It was at a rally in Wisconsin that Elon Musk was holding to support a state Supreme Court candidate. And that's when billionaire Antonio Gracias, a friend of Musk's working with DOGE, showed a chart. And it showed about 5.5 million non-citizens who've gotten Social Security numbers through a program called Enumeration Beyond Entry over the last 6 years, with a big uptick during the end of the Biden administration. And Musk came to this conclusion.
It was a massive, large-scale program to import as many illegals as possible, ultimately to change the entire voting map of the United States and disenfranchise the American people and make it a permanent deep blue one-party state from which there would be no escape.
So Musk and Gracias say they found evidence that non-citizens with Social Security numbers were registered to vote and cast ballots.
Stephen, over to you. What evidence do they have to back up the claims they're making?
Well, Juana, Gracias went on Fox News a few days later and said they dug into Social Security data, found and tracked these people through other databases, and saw that some of these folks are on benefit programs.
Just because we were curious, we then looked to see if they were on the voter rolls. And we found in a handful of cooperative states that there were thousands of them on the voter rolls and that many of them had voted.
It's important to note a few things here. One, non-citizens do wind up on voter rolls, usually by mistake. But audits of state-level voter data have found a few examples of non-citizens actually voting. I mean, it's a federal crime punishable with prison and deportation. Two, voting experts say this sort of cross-checking that DOGE describes can be prone to many kind of errors. That's because states' public voter rolls don't typically include things like Social Security numbers and full granular data that would make matching like this be precise. Three, immigrants who are becoming naturalized citizens can get Social Security numbers through the EBE program, for example, so these could be legitimate voters.
And we reached out to Social Security to get more information about DOGE data access. The agency declined to answer detailed questions about that. They did confirm that a chart Gracias publicized showing totals of non-citizens with Social Security numbers through EBE was taken from an agency dashboard, but they claim that a judge's restraining order prevented them from providing more broken out data. The agency also said the information collected on this topic happened before that restraining order.
Stephen, I want to talk more about that restraining order. How did it come about?
Well, Gracias is one of 10 DOGE staffers at the Social Security Administration, according to court documents in a lawsuit. They also say Gracias was never given access to Social Security databases or personally identifying information. So there's some major questions here about what data he's looking at to make these claims about non-citizens, especially because a judge issued a temporary restraining order blocking DOGE access to Social Security data as of March 20th, and that is still in place. As recently as this week, the government still says Gracias doesn't have access to sensitive information. It's also notable in trying to lift the ban, Social Security listed a few people and projects that DOGE is supposed to be working on. None of them mentions Gracias or checking for non-citizen voting.
Jude, I'm hoping you can just put this in a bigger context for us. How does this fit with the wider efforts to claim that there is large-scale non-citizen voter fraud? I know you've been covering that for the past year.
Well, yeah, well, just yesterday, the House of Representatives passed the SAVE Act, which President Donald Trump has backed. It's a bill that would make sweeping changes to voter registration in the name of election integrity, including requiring voters showing a proof of citizenship document to register to vote. And in the House debate, we saw Florida Congressman Aaron Bean reference DOGE's latest allegations.
The DOGE team just announced millions of illegals now have Social Security numbers. It's happening, and it ends today when we vote on this SAVE Act.
So what DOGE is putting out is directly advancing a political agenda.
And Stephen, as we mentioned earlier, DOGE has been given broad access to data at other federal agencies, too. So is this playbook happening elsewhere?
Well, yes and no. There have been more than a dozen lawsuits that have sought to block DOGE from data, highlighted concerns about who has that data and what they're doing with it. But the Trump administration is taking steps to sort of codify DOGE's larger methodology and focus into the government writ large. There's one executive order that Trump signed last month that directs agencies to facilitate, quote, both the intra and inter-agency sharing of records. There's also another one that directs the Department of Homeland Security and DOGE to, quote, review each state's publicly available voter registration list, among other requests. And Juana, that's similar to what Gracias is doing here at the Social Security Administration. So this particular case and this particular set of data use is not a one-off pattern here, but it's part of a larger plan that's going to transcend DOGE's time at Social Security and across the rest of the government.
NPR's Stephen Fowler and Jude Joffe Block, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
In Syria, the new government's effort to disband militias and create a national army has run into roadblocks. One of them is the Druze religious minority. It says it is keeping its weapons because it is distrustful of the new government and fears sectarian attacks. NPR's Jaina Raff reports from the southern province of Sweda.
Doves cooing in cages hung from black stone walls are the loudest sound at Ain Zaman, a Druze shrine in the city of Sweda. Women come and go, some bringing newborn babies for blessings. The Druze faith is an offshoot of Shia Islam, which has adopted features of other religions, including the belief in reincarnation. Druze make up less than 3% of Syria's population, but they're a majority in Sweda, Syria's southernmost province, which borders Jordan and the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. In an overwhelmingly Sunni Muslim country, Druze over the centuries have carved out a refuge around the volcanic mountains and fertile soil here. Druze militias secure the region. They say the forces of the new government, formed after President Bashar al-Assad fled last December, are not welcome here. In the village of Kanawat, Druze elders and visiting dignitaries crowd a reception hall, waiting to see the Druze spiritual leader, Sheikh Hikmat al-Hijri. Hijri says they fear the Islamist militant group that overthrew the old regime.
Armed terrorist factions now consider themselves in charge of the administration in Damascus. This is neither acceptable on the Syrian level nor internationally.
Fundamentalist Sunni Muslim militants consider the Druze infidels. In 2015, a Sunni militant group killed dozens of Druze in Idlib province, where most fighters supporting Syrian Prime Minister Ahmed Ashara are from. Hijri, who is 75, says talks continue with Ashara, but the Druze so far have not agreed to integrate their fighters into the national security forces. Shara has tried to assure minority groups they'll be safe in the new Syria. But in March, hundreds of Alawites, the Shia sect of the deposed prime minister, were killed by Sunni militants near Latakia. Druze worried they would be next, evacuated to Sueda. Militia fighters welcomed them home. It's late at night and we're on the highway between Damascus and Sueda. There are all of these buses coming back and they're filled with students, more than 1,000 of them, Druze students from the Druze religious minority who have come back from the coast where there have been killings of the Alawite minority. Some of them danced in the aisles in celebration as they crossed Druze checkpoints to the relative safety of their home province. What were you studying?
I'm studying a Faculty of Economics. I'm in the graduation year.
That's Amir Al-Badish. He's 23, and he was supposed to graduate in a few months and help build this new Syria. Instead, the community has retreated to the Druze heartland, and their militias are preparing for battle. We go to the home of Sheikh Yasser Abu Fakhr. His horse Wafa, Loyalty, is tied up outside. He says his Men of Dignity movement has fighters in 100 villages on the mountains, armed with rifles, machine guns, rockets, and mortars to fight government forces if they have to. Some of the weapons were seized from abandoned regime army bases in December. We're ready. We have weapons and we will not let them enter our mountains, he says. Abu Fakhr, like most militia commanders in Sueda, reject help from Israel, which has warned it will attack Syrian government forces if they threaten the Druze, who also have a presence in Israel. But there are other militias forming.
Marhaba.
Yeah, welcome.
Among the newest is the Sueda Military Council, led by Tariq Ashoufi, an officer who defected from the previous regime. We ask the free world, led by the United States, and we ask Israel to defend the entire Druze nation against any extremist attack, he says. At a village meeting, his host smashed the coffee cup he's been drinking from, a local tradition to signify their respect. He asks the men to fight with him. The response, battle songs. Our swords are flashing like lightning. We will never accept humiliation, they chant. Jane Araf, NPR News, Sueda, Syria.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Imagine Los Angeles in the late 70s. In a smoke-filled room, old friends plug in some amps and turn up the volume.
Every Wednesday night, we'd go over there and we would jam.
That is Jeff Bridges. Back then, he was in his late 20s. He was already a movie star with a couple Oscar nominations, but he was always playing music, including at those weekly jam sessions with old high school friends.
There were rules to the jam, the main one being that no songs were allowed. Even songs that we were writing weren't allowed. It was just a free-form jam. Playing instruments that you don't know how to play, a saxophone just hanging from the rafters by a piano string, and anybody could go up and just, wail on it.
Eventually, the crew did work on some proper songs, songs that Bridges had been writing, and they got them down on tape.
We got a little space and, you know, got a funky one of those TIAC four-track tape recorders, and we went to town.
Decades later, Bridges found a cassette tape of those recordings, and now he's releasing it as an album called Slow Magic. When we chatted earlier this week, I asked him to take me back in time to those late 70s jam sessions. There is kind of like a haze to this music. Like at one point you're singing about Quaaludes. There's definitely a vibe, right, to these jam sessions. So may I ask, what helped create that vibe?
Oh, well, you know, this was the age of experimentation.
You know, so to speak.
LSD, Quaaludes, cocaine, pot, all of the things. It was kind of an innocent time. We hadn't seen the dark side of those substances. Yeah. We learned about that, you know, years later, thank God. But it was a wild time. You know, two of the tunes on the album, Kong and Here on This Island, talking about experimentation, Burgess Meredith was included in both of those songs. And people, you know, my age probably remember Burgess from the old Batman series with Adam West. And prior to that, he was a big star on Broadway, you know, back in the 40s. So we did this song, Kong. Burgess sang on that song. And then he said, say, I've got a poem. Do you guys want to back me on this poem? And he recited this poem, Here on This Island.
Here on this island, which we sought and found, the only problem we have on so finding is the awareness night and day that you've brought a fiddle.
I understand that all of the music we hear on this album came from a single cassette tape. Can you tell me about that tape?
Yeah, it was a cassette. On the cassette, it was marked, 77 to 78. But I think some of those tunes go back earlier than that.
And what did you think you were going to do with that tape? Like, why not release that music years ago? What was stopping you?
Yeah, it's funny. Every once in a while we'd say, yeah, let's make a band and take this further. But we were all into other stuff, and that fantasy never really materialized. It's funny. My parents loved showbiz, particularly acting, and they both encouraged all of their kids to go into acting. And when I was a teen, you know, who wants to do what their parents wanted to do? And I said, I got music. Maybe you think of music.
Music made you different from your parents.
Well, Dad would say, no, Jeff, you're going to be called upon as an actor to do all of these things you're interested in.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a great path. And I'm glad I followed his advice. But the seed of music has always been in me. And thank God it blooms from time to time. You know, it's almost kind of a seasonal thing, you know, and it'll come out. It wants to be expressed. There's a thing that I did when I was sick and had some downtime.
Right. You battled cancer
cancer and COVID at the same time.
And COVID while you were. COVID made the cancer
look like nothing. But, you know, I'm 75. To think of, I don't know if I've got the energy to get a band together, rehearse all the songs, go into a studio, record. I said, I'm just going to go into my music mine, M-I-N-E, and see if there are any tunes in there just to put out, you know. Now you can pass it on or you can expose the plot. Oh,
you could smile or not. When you listen back to this music and hear yourself from almost half a century ago, what do you hear? Like, what are you noticing about yourself back then?
You know, I don't feel I've changed much since I was a little kid. You know, I'm basically the same guy, just doing the same thing. The big plus for me was wonderful getting the music out and having people listen.
Yeah.
But it also brought together all these old friends, you know, that we hadn't seen each other. Like you said, some of them in a half a century.
Yeah.
And we got to, you know, kind of rekindle these relationships. And that was wonderful.
Well, you are now like most well-known as a performer on the screen, but playing music itself is also a performance, right? So I was wondering, is there something that's special about performing music that you can't tap into when you're performing for film or TV? What's different about performing music?
Well, in music, in my case, I'm writing these songs, you know, so that I'm not writing the movies. Sometimes we'll do improvisations in film and that'll be, you know, captured.
Sure.
But when it gets down to it, all of my creative endeavors are coming from the same place. Mm. And it's just the task is basically getting out of the way and let the thing do you, you know.
Yeah.
Whether it's a part or, you know, you prepare, certainly, but then, at the moment you let it all go and, you know, you pray, please take me where you want me to go, kind of thing.
Jeff Bridges, his new album is called Slow Magic, 1977 to 1978. Thank you so much for this conversation. It was such a fun ride.
nice jamming with you.
It's nice jamming with you, Jeff.
Yeah, all right. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
As a fact checker for The New Yorker, Austin Kelly once had to call Shaquille O'Neal
to check the spelling of the tattoo that was right next to his navel, which I think was Lil Warrior. So we were thorough.
His new novel, The Fact Checker, and all the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Author Jasmine Guillory writes romance novels about heterosexual couples.
But her ninth novel features two women.
There have been a number of times in the past few years where I have done something new and scary, and my friends, like, cheer me on.
The book Flirting Lessons after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. A federal judge in Maryland blasted a Department of Justice lawyer today who could not explain why the Trump administration has not moved to get a Maryland man back to the United States. This after the 29-year-old Kilmar Abreu Garcia was mistakenly deported last month to a prison in El Salvador. Outside the courthouse, Garcia's attorney, Simon Sandoval Mussenberg, said he's getting frustrated.
For the second time in this case, they sent a lawyer into court who had no answers. He explained that his clients, the government, have chosen not to give him any information, not to give him any evidence.
Judge Paul Zinnes is now ordering the Justice Department to provide daily updates on the status of plans to bring Abreu Garcia back to the United States. The ordering systems for two U.S.-made models of Tesla cars have now been suspended in China. This comes after the U.S. imposed a 145% tariff on China, and China announced a 125% tariff on U.S. imports. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Tesla did not say why orders for its Model S and Model X cars were suspended on its website in China. The two models are Tesla's least popular and are made in the U.S. and imported to China, where Tesla has invested billions of dollars into two large factories near Shanghai to build electric vehicles and batteries. The cars Tesla makes in China make up a majority of its sales. Tesla CEO Elon Musk is a close ally of President Trump, but despite Musk's big bet on China, Trump has targeted China in an escalating trade war, and China responded by putting a blanket 125% levy on American goods. Musk lashed out at Trump's trade advisor Peter Navarro this week, calling him a, quote, moron and dumber than a sack of bricks. Emily Fang, NPR News.
And from Washington, this is NPR News. Thousands of indigenous people from Brazil and other countries marched in the country's capital, Brasilia, this week, urging authorities to protect their land, the environment, and the climate. Julie Carnello reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Indigenous groups chant as they deliver a letter to the president of COP30, Ambassador André Correa do Lago, and hold up a banner saying, "The answer is us." COP30 will be held in the Brazilian Amazon this year, and indigenous groups want to have a say in climate policies. Thousands gathered at the yearly free land camp in Brasília, urging authorities to move away from fossil fuels.
A gente tem feito todo o esforço.
We're striving for indigenous people to have protagonism and be part of the solution at COP30, said Brazil's Minister for Indigenous Peoples, Sonia Guajajara. To think of the future is to act now, she said. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
After 2 days of golf at the Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, Justin Rose has a one-stroke lead at 8-under par ahead of Bryson DeChambeau, who's at 7-under. Rory McIlroy and Corey Connors are tied for third at 6-under par. McIlroy was the story of the day Friday, shooting a 6-under-66 to climb back into contention as he seeks his first Masters green jacket. Defending champ Scotty Scheffler is 5 strokes back. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The federal judge who ordered the return of a Maryland man who was mistakenly deported by the federal government is pushing the Trump administration to move faster to bring him back to the U.S. That judge held a status conference today, less than 24 hours after the Supreme Court mostly upheld her original order and directed the Trump administration to facilitate the man's return. But at a hearing today, a lawyer for the Justice Department said that the government needs more time to comply with that order. NPR's Joel Rose was at the courthouse today and joins us now. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so set the stage for us. What was it like in that courtroom today?
It was tense. I mean, this was the same court where just a week ago, the judge, Paula Zinnes, ordered the Trump administration to bring Kilmar Abrego-Garcia back to the U.S. He had been living in Maryland for over a decade and had a form of protected status that should have prevented his deportation to El Salvador. Despite that, ICE officers arrested Abrego-Garcia last month and deported him to El Salvador, along with hundreds of other men that the Trump administration also accuses of being gang members. Abrego-Garcia denies that. The government says that he was deported to El Salvador because of an administrative error, but argued there is nothing the administration can do now because Abrego-Garcia was already out of the U.S. and in a Salvadoran prison. Judge Zinnes did not accept that argument, and last night the Supreme Court denied an emergency appeal from the Trump administration and sent the case back to the judge.
Right. And what did Judge Zinnes do today exactly?
She asked the Justice Department's lawyers to answer some basic questions about Abrego-Garcia, including simply where he is. And the Justice Department's lawyer said he did not have that information for her. Zinnes asked what, if anything, the administration had done so far to try to bring him back. Again, the lawyer said he did not have that answer either. The lawyer, Drew Ensign, said that the Trump administration does intend to comply with the Supreme Court's order, but he said the judge was demanding answers on a timetable that was simply not practical. The Justice Department had said the same in briefs before the status conference. Judge Zinnes was clearly frustrated today. She says the Trump administration has had plenty of time to fix this mistake. It's been more than a week since they publicly admitted the error. Zinnes today ordered the Trump administration to provide daily status reports on Abrego-Garcia's whereabouts and on the administration's efforts to facilitate his return.
What was the reaction from Abrego-Garcia's lawyers to all of this?
They are clearly frustrated, too. Simon Sandoval-Moschenberg is one of Abrego-Garcia's lawyers, and he talked to reporters after the hearing, and he complained about the lack of information so far.
That was the most shocking thing of all, that the attorney for the government wasn't even prepared to answer the question, where is Kilmar Abrego today? I was very dismayed and disheartened by the fact that they wouldn't answer such a straightforward question.
Sandoval-Moschenberg says he's hopeful the Trump administration will start being more forthcoming. But if they are not, he says he is prepared to suggest some possible remedies to the court.
Well, we mentioned that the Supreme Court mostly upheld the judge's order here. What was the exception that the Supreme Court made?
Yeah, the Supreme Court raised a question about the wording of Zinnes' original order when she said that the administration should, quote, effectuate the return of Abrego-Garcia. DOJ objected to that word. They argued that the court overstepped its authority when it comes to foreign policy. The Supreme Court asked Zinnes to clarify. She released a new revised order last night that directed the administration to take all available steps to facilitate the return. Zinnes says that should put it to rest, but the Trump administration does not agree. So still a lot of questions about where this is going.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
Author Jasmine Guillory is trying something new. After writing 8 romance novels about heterosexual couples, her 9th features 2 women.
My new book, Flirting Lessons, is about Avery and Taylor.
Avery, she says, is kind of uptight.
She's about to turn 30 and feels like she should go out and do more fun things, but doesn't quite know how.
And then she meets the charismatic Taylor, who offers to teach Avery how to flirt.
They embark on a series of flirting lessons, and then it becomes a little romance between the two of them.
Like her character Avery, Jasmine Guillory undertook this big new thing, writing a sapphic novel with a little help from a friend. In her case, that friend is fellow author Amy Spalding. Spalding has written sapphic love stories before. Her latest book, On Her Terms, came out in February. And when Guillory reached out in a what the heck am I writing kind of moment, Spalding was there for her. In conversation with each other about their work, Guillory and Spalding teased out what's so great about trying new things in writing and in life.
Avery comes into the book nervous about doing something new. She has just kind of gotten out of this relationship that was bad, and now she's doing things that she does not know how to do and is scared to do. And she has this conversation kind of early in the book with Taylor about why would anyone want to do something that they're bad at? Like, you have to be bad at something in order to get good at it.
Yeah, I thought a lot about that theme too while writing On Her Terms, because one thing that I think about a lot, just as me, not just as the writer me, but as the human me, I think there's a real joy, a real learning experience, that if you're willing to open up and try new things and be willing to be bad at something at first and to be willing to not be perfect. But every time I put myself in that scenario, I'm like, oh my God, people are looking at me. This is so awkward. I felt like when you said, like, when Avery says, why would I do something if I can't be perfect at it? I just, like, I literally hear, like, a therapist pen, like, going across her notepad, like, girl. But I try hard to make myself sometimes be bad at a thing or try a new thing. Oh, I don't like it either.
No, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And ultimately good for us, and ultimately, like, yes, a very good thing, and I'm grateful that I did it. But in the moment, it's terrifying. Yes.
You're not going to be great at everything you try, and that is also a good lesson to learn and hold to yourself. I will also say something about writing On Her Terms, which I think is really also true for flirting lessons, is that often when you try something new, when you take a step out of your comfort zone, when you do a thing that sort of feels labeled not you, you actually are going to have a lot of support in your life.
Yes.
I think what you picture and what our characters definitely picture is that everyone around them is going to say, why are you doing this?
I mean, thinking about myself, like, there have been a number of times in the past few years where I have done something new and scary and have sent, like, messages to the group chat. And invariably, my friends, like, cheer me on and are excited for me and tell me the things that I need to do in order to go do the thing that I'm scared to do.
I think relatedly, like you said, so many of us, you start to get to your 30s and 40s, you feel a little set of like, oh, I guess this is who I am, and this is the things I do, and that's fine. But one theme that I'm interested in exploring in all my books is the idea that, like, you feel like, oh, everyone else knows how to be a person, but we're all figuring it out. We're all putting pieces together. We're all sort of grappling with what's an adult, what's someone who has a happy life, where do I fit into this?
Yeah, and I think people who are trying to figure out how to be a person at every age they are and what they want in life and what they want out of friendships and relationships, both those people in real life and in fiction, are much more interesting people.
Yes.
To talk to and read about and care about than kind of people who aren't curious about life. Like, I want to know people in real life and have those relationships in real life and write in fiction and read in fiction those people who are curious and interested about what would happen if you changed your life in one of many different ways.
Jasmine Guillory's new novel, Flirting Lessons, and Amy Spalding's On Her Terms are both out now.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Saturday is Record Store Day, which celebrates the culture of independent record stores. Just a few years ago, shops dealt with the great vinyl shortage. But now that shortage is over, largely thanks to a small company in the Czech Republic. Darian Woods from The Indicator and WNXP's Justin Barney bring us this story.
To understand how a Czech company came to end the vinyl shortage and become a giant under capitalism, we need to first go back to the 1900s. At that time, it was Czechoslovakia, and they were basically the Midwest of Europe. And then after World War II, Czechoslovakia became a communist country.
And they needed exactly one factory for music and built Gramofonov Zavody. Its role was to produce music for the Eastern Bloc.
Usually these were very pro-government, pro-communist, and either very political or that easy, cheap pop stuff that would not make any damage by listening to.
That is Michael Sturber. He is the CEO of the company that is now named GZ Media. The company began with sort of safe pop music back in the day.
At that time, the biggest artist was a gentleman called Karel Gott.
Yep, certainly sounds like it won't do any damage by listening to this. Yeah. Not exactly Rage Against the Machine.
Very safe.
In 1989, the communist government fell, and their state-owned business became private.
Being a state-sanctioned monopoly for almost 40 years really gave GZ a leg up in the competitive world of capitalism. They built up their plants over all those years with expensive equipment, and newcomers found it hard to compete.
The problem was the vinyl industry was in the tank.
Because most of music listening happens in the car, and you can't play a vinyl record in the car. Cassettes and CDs took over.
So around 2005, something unexpected happened. Vinyl started coming back.
This was the first vinyl boom. And then the pandemic hit. With no restaurants to go to or concerts to attend, people bought records, and the second vinyl boom began.
So it was the golden time for us.
The second boom started a gold rush in manufacturing. A bunch of new vinyl manufacturers popped up, but they still couldn't keep up with demand.
There are a mystifying amount of small steps involved in pressing a vinyl record.
And many of these steps were outsourced.
This is where GZ changed the game. They started making their own machines to take care of all those small steps so they could do everything in-house.
In business, we call this vertical integration. GZ is the only fully vertically integrated vinyl manufacturer in the world, allowing them to do things on the cheap. The end of the COVID boom has returned vinyl demand to a normal 7% growth. And now there is more capacity to make vinyl than there is demand for it. Mark Michaels is the CEO of United Record Pressing.
It's going to be hard for everybody to survive.
Meanwhile, GZ built a new plant in Nashville called Nashville Record Pressing, just minutes away from United Record Pressing, swallowing up demand and contracts and printing a lot of records.
What can I say? I want to be tough. like you want to excel. That's the nature of human being. Like, I want to win.
Justin Barney.
Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Every week, there's a new main character, someone or something the internet is obsessed with. Well, hosting All Things Considered is a busy job, and I can't always keep up with all the internet discourse. Luckily, one of our resident young people, producer Mia Venkat, is extremely online, and she is here to keep me hip. Mia, do people still say hip?
No.
Okay, well, I'm learning already.
Hey, but that's why I'm here, Ari.
Okay, so tell me, who has the internet become obsessed with this week?
Okay, Ari, can I get a drum roll, please?
Drum roll.
HBO's White Lotus star, Walton Goggins.
Well, even evil things shouldn't be treated like It's only going to make them more evil.
Do you know who he is?
Actually, a friend of mine, David Mack, wrote a deep dive investigative piece on whether he is hot or not. I'm sorry, David, I didn't actually read the piece. But is that why he's main character of the week?
It's part of the reason. And honestly, I don't really want to talk about it because I think...
Because this is NPR.
This is NPR and we're serious, Ari. But is he hot or not? Let's get in. your friend wrote an article, and let me say, I think it's one of maybe like 20 I've seen about the subject. Here's one headline from Vogue. Why I'm hot for Walton Goggins' hairline.
Oh, wait, he has a high hairline.
It's back there. And here's another one from Times of India from this week. Is a receding hairline sexy? White Lotus's Walton Goggins is paving the way.
I love framing him as a trailblazer for having a high hairline.
Personally, as a woman of Indian descent, thrilled to see Times of India getting involved in the Goggins goss. But yeah, sure, he has a receding hairline. He's got kind of like big veneers, like
wild
he's got a
veneers.
Big smile. But I think what this really comes down to is the tale as old as time. Men have no idea what women find attractive. And people are into Walton Goggins because he has charisma, he's funny, he's goofy.
Yes, and abs.
Yeah,
he does have abs.
And he's
Come
and
on.
The photo shoots have made that clear. But I think it's like he just has really great vibes. So he's hot. Like, God forbid a man with a receding hairline, massive veneers, also has good vibes, and people are calling him hot. Do we need a million think pieces on it? Probably not.
It reminds me of when Patrick Stewart starred in Star Trek back in the 90s, and the debate was over bald men being hot. This is the 2025 version of
exactly.
that. So is he main character of the week solely because of the hot or not debate?
That's part of it. But another part of it is the Double Goggins Sundae.
Double Goggins? That sounds like a delicious dessert.
The Double Goggins Sundae. So obviously White Lotus, hugely popular HBO show. That's at 9 p.m. on Sundays. Mm-hmm. We had our last one with the finale this week. Right afterwards, The Righteous Gemstones airs. That's a show about...
Mega church family.
Yeah, family that runs a mega church. It's really silly. It's fun. Walton Goggins plays a crazy character on that show. He plays Uncle Baby Billy.
That's what I need right there. My own game show.
Uncle Baby Billy, isn't this just exactly the pitch for Family Feud?
There ain't no Family Feud. This is Baby Billy's Baba Bonkers.
Costumey outfits, wild accent.
They are yin-yang roles, where
totally.
White Lotus, he's all interior brooding, and the Righteous Gemstones, he's over-the-top nutso.
Absolutely, and I think a big reason why this week, with it being the last Double Goggins Sundae, people are kind of giving him his acting flowers. Like, that is a crazy range to have.
The man is acting with a capital ACK.
Sure.
So we've got Is He Hot or Not, Double Goggins Sundae. Is that the totality here?
Okay, I'm glad you asked. Because this last part, I, as a journalist, struggle to share with you. Because a lot of it is totally speculative. But there's a lot of speculation on the inter-cast dynamic.
Oh, and he has this much younger actress playing his girlfriend on the show.
Yeah, Amy LaWood plays Chelsea, his on-screen girlfriend. And they do have a lot of chemistry on screen, but on top of that, after the show wrapped, they've kind of both, especially Goggins, has posted a lot about her and about their character's love life. And he posted this like 18 picture series on his Instagram story of just the two of them together from their time in Thailand. And then she also posted something about Rick and Chelsea, their characters. And both of these respective posts, Ari, were set to the song Silver Springs by Fleetwood Mac.
But to me, this feels like tale as old as time, like when A Star is Born came out. Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper were doing exactly this, and the internet reacted in exactly the same way.
That could be part. It could just be a PR thing to get people to watch the show. I think it's like, this is kind of like what the internet does, which is make something out of nothing. There's always going to be investigators online of like, who unfollowed who and what happened, and no one ever knows. This is all speculative, obviously. I don't know.
The important part is that all of this allows us to say that this week the internet has been wearing Goggins goggles.
Ari, do you know that that's an actual thing?
Wait, what? Goggins goggles? I didn't just make that up in this moment.
He has a sunglass company called Walton Goggins Goggle Glasses.
No.
Because if your goggles ain't Goggins, they don't belong on your noggins.
That's real.
And that is not an endorsement.
And his fangirls are called the Goggins Girlies. So this week is for the Goggins Goggles and the Goggins Girlies.
The Goggins Goggles and the Goggins Girlies. Thank you, Mia Venkat.
Thank you, Ari.
Tony Award-winning composer and lyricist William Fenn died in Vermont on Monday from lung disease. He was 73 years old. Best known for falsettos and the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, Fenn wrote highly idiosyncratic musicals with inventive wordplay. Jeff London offers this appreciation.
William Fenn had been toiling in off-Broadway obscurity until 1981, when March of the Falsettos got rave reviews. It told the story of a neurotic New Yorker named Marvin who leaves his wife and son for a man.
We're the mad, we're often mad, too often mad, we're very mad, that we're the mad experimenters, call us for twos, itching for answers.
Not yet 30, William Fenn's career was launched.
He was sui generis. Nobody like him. Never met anybody like him.
Director and writer James Lapine collaborated with Fenn several times, including on March of the Falsettos and its sequel, Falsetto Land, which dealt with the AIDS crisis. The shows were combined in 1992 into Falsettos, and both men won Tony Awards.
He wrote very stream of consciousness, but he was a brilliant guy. And he shaped his material in an interesting way.
William Fenn said he shared a lot of characteristics with the sometimes abrasive character of Marvin.
I didn't realize what a fart he was till I saw it on stage. And when I was writing him, I thought he was unbelievably charming, as I am. I'm not that easy.
I never wanted, I wanted, I never, 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 never wanted to love you.
William Fenn brought himself into all of his writing, including his most popular show, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, which was about the love of language.
At the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
Rachel Schenken, who won a Tony working on the show, says William Fenn loved discovering emerging voices. The two taught in the musical theater writing program at NYU. When she last saw him in March, they talked about the students.
He said, make them write about themselves. And that was really Bill's power as a teacher. He was able to draw out personal stories and personal voices, and then to champion them.
But you gotta have heart and music. You gotta have heart and music. Heart and music, get along.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
You gotta have heart and music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Arm, with the new podcast series, Tech Unheard. Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to tech company leaders like Aisha Evans from Amazon's self-driving car subsidiary, Zoox, about how tech is helping to shape the future of computing. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
But the place from where I come, I got a sweet someone they took lessons from. He seems to be all right for me, cause I can handle him, you see. I know he can't be true, but then I love him, indeed I do. Have you met my counterfeit Bill from Louisville? I'm kinda sure you will, cause he's a honey who looks like ready money. I just got one big complaint.